Coming up today, the race to create a VR AI-powered immortal Elton John, the rise of fake AI pornography, and we find out how plastic is spreading diseases on coral reefs. This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by the Museum of London. The museum tells the ever-changing story of this great city and its people. This year, the museum has a season of events and displays called City Now, City Future, which explores the challenges, initiatives and innovations taking place within our cities. To find out more, go to museumoflondon.org.uk. You're listening to episode 353 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
And that's it. Facts, please.
I'm going to go first because I think I've got a good one this week. So, in 1975, KFC, well, technically the parent company of KFC, which was called Hublin Inc. at the time, unsuccessfully sued Colonel Sanders, the creator of KFC. Sanders himself had said that the gravy was sludge and like wallpaper and had a wallpaper taste. Sorry, I couldn't read my own notes.
I had no idea you got gravy at KFC.
What?
That's a big thing.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever been.
You know what I'm confused about? What happened to Colonel Sanders for him to like backlash against KFC? I thought those guys would be tight.
No, I don't know, but I think he like sold it or something at some point because he tried to sue them at another point and I think he won. I can't remember, but it was somewhere I was reading Wikipedia about his sort of battle, and apparently he used to go into stores but towards the end of his life, and if things weren't good, like throw food on the floor.
Oh, and then,
so you could say he was angry to no longer be on the KFC gravy train.
Ooh. Ooh. He's gone from not knowing great KFC did gravy to straight in with the gravy puns.
Yep. You don't need to know anything to do a good pun.
No.
Apart from how to pun. Matt Reynolds.
So, you know how like a court case has usually got, you know, a boring name? It's like The Crown versus Burgess or United States versus Templeton. Well,
Hublin versus Sanders.
Yes, exactly. There was a court case, I can't remember when this was, that was called United States versus approximately 64,694 pounds of shark fins. Which was basically just about this ship that had loads of shark fins outside Guatemala and they kind of like intercepted it. And it's because when you have a case like that, there's this like weird court case thing where you actually have the case against the object instead of the person. So you have these really funnily named court cases. Another good one is United States versus article consisting of 50,000 cardboard boxes, more or less, each containing one pair of clacker balls.
Good.
Which is brilliant.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there's more.
Oh, there's so many of these online.
I want one every week.
Yeah, they're really good.
For the rest of the year.
Those were two good facts. You've got it.
They were great. Mine's more of a general wondering, but there's a fact involved. So the doomsday clock ticked another 30 seconds towards midnight this week. We're now 2 minutes from annihilation, according to the board of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. So the bulletin takes several factors into consideration when calculating the time on the clock: nuclear threats, climate change, biosecurity, bioterrorism, and miscellaneous threats, including cyber warfare and AI.
Very cool. Well,
I like how the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists have been like, we're going to have to branch ourselves out to some other things, really.
Yeah, so it was established in 1947 by, I think, an awful lot of the scientists that worked on the Manhattan Project, which is the US nuclear weapons program, when they realised, oh dear God, what have we done? So the aim being to stop nuclear weapons from ever being used again. So this acts as a warning. In 1947, it was 7 minutes from midnight. And since then, it's sort of been getting ever closer. Apart from in 1991, at the end of the Cold War, we went 17 minutes to midnight. That's the furthest it's ever been away. And ever since, we've sort of been getting closer and closer, particularly in recent years, as North Korea and Russia and the United States have all kind of had a war of words, which is concerning. So it might seem a bit like a gimmick, but it's based on rationale. It's based on factors. And it's sort of meant to act as a way of showing that we're in trouble.
It's a really bad way of setting your clock on the oven, though, if you're not sure what the time is.
Yeah.
Don't go for the Atomic Bulletin scientists. They're always It's always just before midnight.
Great.
Clock setting joke.
Absolutely terrible. You're not on my gravy train. Right, okay, our first story this week. It's all about Elton John and his quest to live forever.
Yeah, so I don't know if you're big Elton John fans.
Huge.
Podcast. Who isn't, right? But he just announced that he's finishing touring, right? He's been touring for about 50 years. And he's just announced that he's putting an end to that. So he's going to do a 300-date world tour for 3 years, and then that's it.
Just the 300 days.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
yeah.
For a 70-year-old man,
he does something like 150 shows a year. And like last year, when he almost died, he still did like 100 shows.
A man loves the stage.
I know, he seriously does. But what's interesting about this is not just that Elton John is ending touring, because where's the tech angle in that? It's how he chose to announce it, and how they kind of did this was this VR. Virtual reality experience that was broadcast in kind of three different places. It was in LA, London, and in New York's Gotham Hall, and it was streamed to these sites simultaneously, as well as on YouTube in not quite VR, basically. And to do this, it involved recreating scenes from Elton's career. So it involved recreating 23-year-old Elton in 1970, his very first US gig. And so I kind of like did a bit of talking to the people that have been behind this project to find out how you do that, really.
And we should say this isn't just about a one-off recreation of Elton John to announce his farewell tour. This is part of a concerted effort to gather as much virtual information about Elton John as possible, so that conceivably he can be brought back to life when he's no longer with us.
Yeah, exactly. So it kind of like the kicking off point has been this kind of like project that was around launching it. But it really, so there's a group called kind of SpinFX, which do these amazing like legacy projects. They do these things for like, they've worked with kind of like the royal families in the UAE to kind of do these huge kind of like legacy projects of kind of like build these stadiums, build these entire islands of stuff. And basically they worked with Elton John to say, well, build future me, perhaps a digital recreation of Elton John that will live beyond his post-biological life.
So he wants his legacy to be himself and a very accurate recreation of himself, and the technology needed to do that is kind of getting there. But as I understand it, when the collaboration started, it was a case of an awful lot of people, including Google, saying no, you can't actually do this, it's impossible.
Yeah, so exactly. So just kind of like go into a bit more detail about the difficulties of doing this. So one of the things, well, if we're talking about how do you recreate someone, right? So one of the things you want to do is you want to be able to capture their motions and their sound and, you know, their kind of like physicality. And to do that with this VR film, they basically got Elton John in Pinewood Studios, in this kind of motion capture studio in London, you know, kitted him out. He played 10 songs at the piano. They had, you know, a bunch of cameras, like, you know, tracking what he was doing. And you know, that's good for this VR experience. They basically then mapped it onto a kind of bubble, a much younger body double that was the kind of 23-year-old Elton. But 10 songs isn't really enough to recreate any movement.
It's not much data, is it, really?
No, exactly. But the problem is that and this is the kind of like task facing the SpinFX group and the people that want to, you know, working on this project of recreating this kind of virtual Elton John, is that they need to spend the next 3 years, you know, the next 3 years when Elton John is at, you know, at current performance fitness, really, he's not going to be that way forever, trying to get as much data as possible so they can kind of come back in 50 years, reinterpret that data and say, okay, now we can use that and we can splice these things together using artificial intelligence, and now we can create, I don't know, an exhibition that has Elton John moving around, you know, convincingly and interacting with people, perhaps. Mm. Or maybe we can put him on stage again, you know, in some kind of like other form. So really the race is on to try and get as much of this data as possible, even if they don't quite know what they're going to do with it right now.
Yeah, so it's just getting that quantity of information. We've seen attempts, there's been a few of them, of creating holograms of celebrities, particularly performance artists, who are no longer with us. But this, we feel, is the most comprehensive, the most ambitious effort to do this yet. And what's really interesting about it is the AI side of things. So as well as capturing all this data so that you can see him perform, you could also capture sort of his persona, his personality.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the kind of like next stage, right? So the first step is let's capture the music, let's capture the audio, let's capture the physical thing. So then we can do whatever, you know, museum exhibits and that type of thing. The other thing is, well, how do we capture the personality? How do we capture the songwriting ability? And the guy I was talking to, who leads this SpinFX group, is a guy called Ben Casey, and he was saying what they want to try and do is, use AI to try and break down Elton's kind of songwriting ability to say, well, what ties all these songs together? You know, what are the kind of like the fundamental building blocks of a Elton John song, if you like? So the idea being that in 50 years, a collaborator could kind of come along and say, you know, what if I gave Elton John this melody? What would he do with it? So this is an incredibly ambitious project to say, well, can we almost using AI recreate the mindset? I mean, Ben had a kind of nice way of putting it that he said, you know, in 50 years, he wants to be able to sit on a piano and have a conversation with a virtual Elton John and say, you know, let's work on this song together. So it's this really ambitious sense to really, I guess, try and distill someone's being and intelligence into AI.
I've got my skeptical face on.
Yeah.
It sounds a little too ambitious, I would say. It's all well and good to say, oh, in 50 years we want somebody else to do this, but I could quite easily turn around and say that for about any other possibility that may exist with some sort of technical application. And I understand that, yeah, you obviously need to have data to be able to do this and sort of without capturing all this stuff about Elton John, how he writes songs, how he does all this stuff, there's not going to be any chance of it at all. But to me, it seems a little bit hypothetical still at the moment.
So it's giving them the opportunity to do it in the future. And what they've been able to do at the moment is kind of a little bit of a gimmick. They had an installation at King's Cross Railway Station in central London. You could look at a screen that showed what you were standing next to, in this case, a piano, where you can see Elton John sitting at the piano, but it's not Elton, it's virtual Elton. So it doesn't really work yet. The hardware isn't there, the processing power isn't there. We're not quite ready for this yet, but it's capturing the data with the possibility that you might be able to do it in the future. And I liked it was Ben Casey you spoke to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
His quote: "From this point onwards, there are endless opportunities for Elton to find ways to outthink the limits of time and geography."
And I think that's the kind of point. And so Ben's been working with a company called, I think they're called Rival Theory, that's it. And they use kind of AI to recreate humans digitally and dead humans. And this is, you know, if you think about a kind of like, a loved one that might have died, you might want to kind of like capture conversations with them and find a way to kind of recreate them in a kind of digital form, whether that's a chatbot or whether that's a kind of, you know, a sophisticated hologram or something. This is something that people really want to do, to be able to capture someone and, you know, project them. You know, you're right, it's not about resurrecting, right? And it's not like we can necessarily create a kind of like organic mind, but Ben kept returning to this phrase, kind of this post-biological self or this post-biological life, and this kind of idea that actually someone can kind of keep creating and perhaps keep coming up with new things, not of his own volition. That'd be kind of scary.
Yeah.
But in collaboration with other people. And I think that idea is kind of interesting. And like you said, James, you're definitely not going to get there if you don't start taking those data points now.
Yeah, and it's also horrendously creepy. And an episode of Black Mirror.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So, which is always a good thing, right, if we're headed that way.
Yeah, well done, Charlie Brooker again. And what was interesting about that, and this is another problem with the data that they capture, is they're only going to capture the public Elton John. So an awful lot of the man's genius will be stuff we don't see, and they're not going to capture the data on that. So in the Black Mirror episode, spoiler alert, but it's from season 2, you should have seen it by now, the person that comes back from the dead is all composed of stuff from the social media profiles. So they don't actually have a personality, because no one's authentic on social media. So that's another problem. Obviously they're only trying to create a performance Elton John, but they're not actually going to be able to recreate the essence of the human being.
No, you're right, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because it leads on to questions kind of like, well, you know, what if I wanted to do this on a more personal level? What are those kind of like bits of someone I take? And then, like you said, it kind of makes you think, well, what are the bits of me that are authentically me and those that are just some kind of, I don't know, projection? So there's this, there's this kind of like problem, and it's interesting to think that people are actually trying to answer it.
Yeah, and Elton John's estate probably has the budget to keep pushing it and to get us somewhere, even if it does take 50 years. You can read an awful lot more about this story. It's really, really fascinating work on Wired at Cut UK. There's a nice in-depth story there that Matt worked on this week. Our second story is one that, if you're listening to this on Friday, you won't be able to read our take on, but it's already gone all around the internet. And this is all about AI-generated fake pornography.
Yeah, I guess if you thought that recreating Elton John post-biological life was slightly creepy, this is going to take that to the next level.
Yeah, and this is genuinely horrendous and borderline tantamount to sexual harassment.
Right? Yeah, this is more of a story about the problems with the ethics in technology and sort of how developing technology is being used. So about a month ago, this is where it sort of all starts. There was a subreddit created on Reddit, which was created by a user called Deepfakes. And on this subreddit, this person started to create and post videos which were originally pornography, but starring actors.
Pornographic actors.
And they had taken data from celebrities, so pictures, videos of sort of them going about their daily business, things that have been captured in public, sort of just being like a data set.
And yeah, they trawled their Instagram feeds and videos of them speaking on television and this sort of thing.
Yeah, things that were publicly available, maybe not available by copyright, but we'll come on to that in a bit. So they had a big database of celebrity faces, and then they basically used and created a machine learning technique to transplant the image of these people. And there's lots of major all-female celebrities, I should point out, onto the pornographic actors. So they're effectively creating fake videos of these actors in pornographic situations, which obviously there is no permission from these people to be put in this sort of position, videos. And they are very sort of basic videos at the moment, but they are pretty well produced in terms of the technique.
Yeah, so the technology's fairly rudimentary, but able to produce, if you like, and this is the wrong phrase to use, but it produces a good effect. It's very good at what it does. We'll get into all the details of the legality and the moral and the ethics side of things, but essentially what this is doing, correct me if I'm wrong, is once you have enough angles of someone's face, be it from a still photo or a video, you can then use the machine learning algorithm, then analyzes the video to understand how the face in the video, the pornographic video, moves. And then for each frame of that video, it finds a corresponding angle from the celebrity's face or whatever face you're wanting to feed into it, and then replaces it.
Yeah, that's basically it. It's contorting the faces, I guess, from some of the images, or finding images that are similar from a data set. And what the newest thing of this is, because as I said, this started last time towards the end of December. There has been an app, which is a desktop app, released this week by some people involved with this. We don't know who the people who are creating these things are, and it's called the Deepfakes app, and it's basically a package of software you can download. You need to have an Nvidia graphics card on your computer to process the data. You need to download some of the Nvidia's I think it's open source software. I don't think it costs anything. And then you have to download some scripts and stuff as well, and create a data set to train the AI on. So it means that now, this was just one person doing it, or a very small number of people, it now means there's a possibility for a lot more people to do it, and you don't necessarily need a huge technical knowledge. You've got to have some. You can't have not used a computer for it before. Yeah. You have to have a sort of basic scripting knowledge. But
the concern being that it's only a matter of time. It's taken 1 month to go from something that one person... Well, lots of people would be able to do this, but one person had come up with the idea and spoken publicly about it on Reddit. But now there's a piece of software that anyone with a bit of technical knowledge can use. How long before that software is simplified? An awful lot of the technical trickery is hidden away back in behind it, and all you have to do is give it someone's Instagram handle and a pornographic video, and voila, in a day it will have produced that video with their face. So at the moment, it's, as you say, predominantly targeted at female celebrities, but the subreddit, since it was written about by Motherboard and it's gone all over the internet, is getting an awful lot more interest, and people popping up making requests for their girlfriends to be put into videos, for certain celebrities to be put into videos, etc., etc. And it's very, very dodgy moral ground, 100%, but it's exceptionally dodgy legal ground, potentially.
Yeah, this is where it gets more, more dodgy than using this for celebrities, because it shouldn't be done for celebrities as well, and it's easy, I think, for people online to forget that these are actual people that you are using their faces for stuff that they obviously have not consented to and would not want to be in this sort of position.
And we're yet to see them making comment on this. It might be the case that their legal teams, in the case of, I think, one of the people in them is Taylor Swift. There's some videos with Katy Perry on the subreddit, I think. You can imagine that they're lawyering up to get these removed, because the people on that subreddit will understand that they're fake, but once they get distributed widely, which is quite likely to happen on the internet, then you kind of lose control.
You do. And some of the people I've been speaking to for our story have been talking about the effects that this has. Like, obviously, this sort of technique is fairly new, but Photoshop and other software is available that can edit images, has been available for a while. So there have been quite a few cases of people photoshopping their friends, their former lovers, their current partners' faces onto other people's bodies. And there have been people arrested for this and gone to jail in Australia, in India, in there's somebody in the UK as well. And it's sort of an issue that is, yeah, this is pretty illegal. There's obviously a few different complexities to this. So the UK has a, well, as it's colloquially known, a revenge porn law, which came into force in 2015. And actually, under the UK law that covers this sort of sexual abuse, yes, there isn't a provision for altered images. So it talks about film and photography, but if you class a film as a small piece of footage which wasn't recorded by somebody and has been altered as a piece of film, it's a complex legal definition. Whereas in Scotland, for instance, the law actually has the word altered in it, so it's a lot more clearer. And there's obviously like a few other technical legal definitions. So this is an area that is hard, like for people to potentially enforce. There's like the person who was accused of this in the UK with a still image was the offences that they were talking about were harassment rather than the sort of the revenge porn laws. And there's potential for copyright if you don't own the images or the videos, which people obviously don't, you would say in most cases. And then there's also potential for other sorts of privacy civil cases, so more not criminal offences, but something where I could sue James for breach of my privacy.
Yeah, I think the reason we wanted to bring this on to the podcast is everyone knows that people have been photoshopping images since even before Photoshop existed. You used a pair of scissors and some clever handiwork. Whereas now it's the right word. It's not commodification, but it's how easy it potentially is to do a very, very complex technical task. And anyone would look at these videos, as we have, to kind of verify what's going on and say, that's that person, that's authentic. And as some of the lawyers and legal experts that you spoke to, Matt, said, we really need to be incredibly, incredibly careful with what happens with this kind of software and what precedent it sets.
Definitely. To ban a piece of software would be very difficult. And it would obviously sort of ping around the internet in different places and things like that. And I think it would be a bad precedent necessarily to set. But the laws need to be able to sort of cover for these sorts of cases coming up and actually give people a recourse and a way to enforce their rights. Because for a lot of non-technical people, if they saw a picture even or a video, they'd probably be more convinced by a video on posted to Facebook or emailed to them or shared from another website of somebody that they knew. They're probably going to believe that it's real, even for a short time,
that's horrendous.
That can damage somebody's reputation. It can damage their job prospects. There was a case, I think, in the US where somebody had photoshopped a woman's face onto another woman's body, and she said in a media interview in the US that her potential employers were looking this up while she was in the room, because they were looking up her, googling her name, and she said that she said this had happened. She admitted it to them, but they still got it up and looked at it in there, and it's like, well, that's gonna cloud somebody's opinion even if they know that it's a fake. So it's a horrible sort of thing to be happening.
So it remains to be seen if any of the celebrities that are involved in this very, very early stage, quite Reddit-y kind of thing, pursue any action against the people that are doing it. And it also remains to be seen what the companies that are enabling this software to get out there do. So at the moment, it's one of the files is hosted on Google Drive. You can imagine that that might be a violation of Google's terms. We've got in touch with Google, but they're yet to get back to us with comment on that. And another mirror of the file is on Mega. Again, one of the options is if the software that's being developed for these purposes, can you chase it off the internet or the open internet so that it's more difficult for people to do it, because what you don't want to end up happening is for this to be turned into a really, really simple application that anyone can use. There's still a little bit of a barrier at the moment, and it probably needs to be stopped before it gets out of hand.
Yeah, and there's actually a few other sort of technological things that have been developed that could lead into sort of this sort of thing being used more often and used more widely. I know that one of the there was a pornography website, I think it was one of the webcam ones where people broadcast themselves and make a living through doing this. They introduced a feature where people could use facial recognition technology to look up a picture of somebody and compare and find out who they, what porn star they look like. And like, if you are looking for to do something like this with changing and altering videos, I mean, I don't want to say that it's, that's a, like a first step that you could do, but it feeds into the overall process. And
to an extent, the people that create this kind of software wash their hands of it. So I think in an interview around the time that that software came out with the face matching on webcam pornography, they said, oh, well, no one's going to use it for anything malicious. It's up to people what they do with it. It's not our responsibility. And writing on Reddit, one user said that they've never heard of revenge porn photography created through Photoshop that's been taken seriously by peers, nor any celebrity fakes that were taken as real by the public. That's not true.
Yeah, they
may not have heard of it, but it's definitely a thing that happens. And as you say, while most people might be aware that images can be faked, fake video is a whole new realm. So we're going to be keeping an eye on this one and seeing what happens. We'll likely be writing about it again. We might bring it back on the podcast. So do stay tuned. Okay, moving on. Our third story, a bit of a change of pace. Ocean plastic. In the UK and around the world, I think it's just aired in America for the first time. Blue Planet 2, David Attenborough's latest BBC nature documentary epic, really shone a light on the impact that we're having on the oceans and also all the amazing things that happen beneath the waves. And one of the things that it really showed was how much plastic there was, and particularly what impact that plastic was having out in the ocean. What it didn't touch on, and which new research has pointed out, is the plastic waste in the world's ocean is potentially, well, not potentially, it is, seemingly, according to their findings, poisoning coral reefs.
Is this coral bleaching, or is it something similar?
So it's completely unrelated. So coral bleaching is to do with acidification in the ocean and changing temperatures and changing currents and things like that. This is to do with the sheer quantity of plastic. And once it breaks down into these tiny, tiny micro pieces of plastic, one of the researchers involved in the work described it as like a load of knives. And so it's like cutting your hand with a knife. If you don't then properly repair that wound or cover that wound, then you're likely to get an infection, you could get a disease, etc., etc. So this is basically what's happening on a massive, massive scale with corals all over the world. So it's some research led by a team at Cornell University found that 89% of corals in the areas that they surveyed were in contact with plastic and contaminated with disease. By contrast, only 4% of corals without, as they called it, plastic entangled in them, had signs of disease. And it's happening for a variety of reasons. So one, the coral's getting cut by the plastic, but two, the plastic also blocks out the amount of sun and the amount of oxygen that gets to the coral. So the corals are getting sick, and then they're getting more likely to get disease, and they're getting cut. And the poor health of the coral combined with all of that means that they're more likely to get diseases, which means they're more likely to die, which means they're more vulnerable to all sorts of threats that we're, if you like, imposing on them for our actions.
It's all our fault. And it's, I guess, in a way, I don't know if you just said this or not, but like an immune system for people, it gets damaged, then you're more likely to be ill again.
These are complex living organisms. So they found that in the Asia-Pacific region, so this was researchers from the US, Australia, Indonesia, Myanmar, and Canada. They surveyed 159 reefs in the Asia-Pacific region, and they estimate that there's 11.1 billion pieces of plastic entangled in reefs across this region. And that's just one part of the globe, admittedly where an awful lot of reefs are, but still. And they predict that this number will increase by 40% by 2025.
Wow. Is there anything we can do to stop this?
So, and this was one of the things, it's why I mentioned Blue Planet 2 at the top of this story, is that even though things are fairly bad for our oceans, there is hope. And if you haven't seen the series yet, I think the last episode focuses on efforts that are being made to reverse the damage that we've done. So where there are fishing regulations in place, where there are new conservation efforts happening, and slowly, well, not even slowly, remarkably quickly, the ocean is recovering, is getting back to what it was before we started ruining everything. So what the team found was that there were diseases such as White syndrome was increasing, black band disease was very much associated with the presence of plastic. But what they found was that it was lower in Australia than it was in Indonesia. And the reason because of that is Australia is a very stable, rich, developed economy. Indonesia is more of a developing economy. And Australia has better provisions for recycling plastic and for reducing plastic waste, whereas Indonesia doesn't. So we're seeing where plastic waste is being reduced, where there's a real effort to combat this, it's having a positive effect. So as everyone lifts up to a higher standard of recycling and being mindful of the environment and sort of all the climate change targets that we've got will help this as well, hopefully, the corals have got a chance. But I think the real takeaway from the research is that we don't have that long left. 40% increase by 2025? Yeah.
And they're important for all kinds of like diversity reasons and protecting coastlines from erosion, right? So they're not just pretty, but they're actually genuinely useful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's more biodiversity in coral reefs than any other ecosystem on Earth. And they're hiding places for fish, they're breeding grounds, they're absolutely essential for not just the natural world, for our world as well, as you say, as flood defences, as sources of food and shelter and protection. So this is a really important issue. And it was interesting after watching Blue Planet 2 to then hear that there's this new piece of research that didn't make it into that show. Mm. So there's this other concern that we need to have, as well as coral bleaching, as well as global warming, as well as climate change, as well as pollution. There's poisoning being caused by plastic. So it's a really, really interesting piece of research. We probably didn't cover it in as much depth as it warranted, but you can read our report on word.co.uk, and there's a link to the paper there, so you can go and read an awful lot more about it. So that's it. We covered a lot of ground,
as we
always do. No quiz.
Oh, yeah, no quiz.
Absolutely no quiz.
Looking forward to the quiz on Elton John's biggest hits.
Here we go. Yeah, I am now going to sing Elton John's biggest hits backwards.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah.
I spent a lot of time while I was doing this story listening to Elton John's biggest hits.
What was your favourite?
Honestly, I quite like... It's kind of sad, isn't it? Because like, you listen to it and it's like, oh, he's ending. He's finishing this. I like
He
Goodbye.
Might not be, though.
I know, yeah. Virtue out on John. Yeah. I like Goodbye, Yellow Brick Road is a good song.
Classic.
He's got loads of good songs. He's one of those artists where actually, you don't... He did I'm Still Standing.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was him.
Yes.
Yeah,
you were trying to think of a pun as well, weren't you? An Elton John VR pun.
Do you want to hear it?
Go on, then.
Oh, I don't know how to set this up, but the pun is, VR, you ready for love?
Brilliant.
You know, I was trying to think for a tweet, can I think of like three? And I looked for a list of Elton John songs. I could not think of another one. So luckily the world escaped that.
We spend our time wisely here in the Wired offices. We will leave it there for this week. Quiz next week, I think. Stay tuned for that. We'll see you again then. Bye-bye.
See ya. Bye.